So I wanted to start with you, Adrian, just to sort of segue from what you were talking about earlier. You mentioned at the end of your talk when you were talking about Australia and how we're doing here. I always want to apologize for my accent. How we're doing here. And I wondered, you talked a little bit about small and medium and larger corporations and where things are happening and where they aren't. Are there certain sectors that are applying using AI more than other sectors?
So there are, but if you think about, the first thing I want to say is the only way we make fast enough progress as a country is if we get organised as a country. We decide what's sovereign, what's important, what's not, and we decide what industries we want to go and build that leverages AI. It's not controversial that we're moving, for example, to renewable energy by 2050. That's going to leave, some say, $160 billion hole in our GDP. What's going to replace it? Has to be these new industries. So the ones that are adopting today are ones that are traditionally information-centric. So you think about media, communications. They're also deriving a lot of value because you can get close feedback loops to train algorithms. You need a lot of data to train. Banks, it'd be another example, fundamentally an information-centric business. Where we see in the mid-cap market, there are actually a lot of emerging mid-caps. So if you look even in the last 12 to 18 months, the ASX and the shift in the ASX and where the growth on the ASX is coming from, you know, WiseTech, Afterpay, those sort of companies, I think when I talk with the investor community too, the super funds and the private equity, they're all looking at that going, hang on a minute, that's where the growth is coming. Actually the last point is the next 10 to 20 years is both the information centric, but it's also cyber physical systems. It's digital ag, it's digital energy, it's digital health, and we have strength in that as a country. If you look, the work we're doing for remote asset management, we've had NASA come into the country and say, you are world leading in remote asset management, you know, can we partner with you and learn from you around that?
Okay. I wonder if, Christina, because you're dealing with clients, do you have anything to comment on in terms of who's willing to pick this up, who's willing to move with it, and who is a little bit more reticent?
We've seen a lot of our clients start to apply AI in their business. The health sector in particular has been very good at applying it. We have a client, for example, that's using AI in breast cancer research and identifying breast cancers. Another client looking at the application of AI in IVF to identify which is the best embryo to implant in an IVF procedure. Other sectors are like the energy sector. We've seen some really great applications in optimising energy models. Every sector we're seeing the application of AI. Even some of the most archaic sectors, if you like, the ones that haven't been the best at adopting technology in the past, they're really latching on to the opportunity that we're seeing.
Fantastic. I guess maybe because it's about ethics, and I know that I could tell even from Adrian's answer, he wanted to move more to the ethical standards and thinking about being the leader in developing those standards. So in Australia, there are the Standards Australia. There's reports coming out from EY. There's reports coming out from all kinds of different directions. So what would be the forum or how would these voices come together and agree to a set of ethical standards? How could that happen? I'm just going to look at all of you and see who puts their hand up for that one.
Look, I might dive in true to form. With Standards Australia, I think it's only appropriate. But look, what Adrian said at the outset is call to action around, as a country, prioritising where we want to focus. We've not been good in the past at picking winners. I think that's always an aversion we have politically, which is a problem. But I think if you start, which is what we've done through the CSIRO Data 61 work around ethical principles, but calling out some of those, and then whittling it down, which is a process which is underway now, The point where we need to get to with standards is really classifying exactly what we're talking about and how we operationalise it. So our challenge always in the standards world is it tends to be very technical. That's a good thing. If I use an analogy from the construction sector, they're very prescriptive, and that's great. So it's around the quality of concrete and all the constitutive elements, and you can use that analogy with digital infrastructure too. And I think we need to get to those specifics. So if we're talking about privacy, define what the actual issues are, not just a broad notion of, oh, I'm worried about my privacy. That doesn't mean anything. And in fact, there's some massive inhibitors to AI through our privacy framework in Australia. And I think that's where we need to get to. So very specific focus on ethical issues and the technical issues that come with that. The other starting point I might add is not just the domestic work we're doing. You know, we're part of the international community. We need to row in that direction too. The OECD have released principles around AI, which have been signed up to by our government with 41 others. So that's, again, another good starting point in terms of how we standardise. Those are all aspirational statements, though. Even when I reflect on when we talk about things like social justice, not inscribed in much of our legislation in Australia. So if you want to talk about how you operationalise that in terms of bias and all those considerations, the hard work will begin in the standards process proper. You know, committees comprised of corporate interests, of government, of academia, of civil society, they all have to be around the table. But whatever we do has to be commercially, I suppose, realisable and real, and it also has to resonate with the broader community. So it's striking a point of consensus, which is not always what we see with either purely government-driven processes or purely market-driven processes.
So, I was going to ask another question following on from that, but you guys move through, please.
Well, maybe just a follow-on from that. I think what's fascinating in the last 4 months or so is an absolute explosion of international activity on this front. So you just alluded to the OECD statement just very recently in May, but before that in February we had the European Parliament resolution on similar issues. Then we had the EU Independent Working Group publication of its principles. That was fascinating because the ethical principles that it published were split into foundation principles, firstly, which are sort of the almost the Asimov style fundamental tenets, and then they have the effectively the realization principles, they call them, which is how you then apply, and then the assessment principles. So they tackle it in a sort of three-tiered approach. Then we have the OECD principles. Those are five, and they're very quite high level, really. I mean, they're very aspirational, as you say, and high level. And then just on the 9th of June, the G20 meeting in Japan ratified a set of principles, which is effectively the same as the OECD principles. And each of those are different. And actually, might I say, I think Data61's done a fantastic job, and your eight are terrific. But again, they're subtly different. You know, they're all come from the same genesis, but they're subtly different. So with that sort of, and that's without even then looking at the excellent work that the likes of Microsoft and others have done in the private sector. So how, as a starting point, how do you come to an international consensus on that, and do you in fact need an international consensus, and then how do you then apply that at a country level? And I think that's an interesting question. Interested in your views, Adrian.
I'm not optimistic about international consensus. I mean, I do think, I mean, if you look at other areas where there's potential to cause harm, we've done it, right? We've done it around chemical weapons, for example. But then, I don't know, if we just go down that thread for a second, think about how the world responded to the Syria situation that then says, okay, I had a scary conversation in the last couple of weeks with somebody who's on the fringes of biological warfare talking about the use of oxytocin with riot crowds, right? So that's like, is that chemical, you know, is that convenient against a chemical convention or not, right? So it's just incredibly complicated. So there's the, can we agree globally? There probably are a set of things, kind of base level values around humanity and life that we can. But then how do you enforce and what are the repercussions? And if we look at cybersecurity as another analog, incredible complexity, even to pin an attack back to the perpetrator of the attack is incredibly difficult, and I think we're struggling now with what are the repercussions, what are the methods and modes of enforcing. So
I think with around the international agreement, the thing about principles or values is that everyone agrees that they're all good, but particularly when it gets complex, you have to start deciding which one am I going to put into play now and which overrides which. Would be pretty difficult, I think, from a universal or international kind of agreement, but happy to hear others.
I was going to say I'm actually a bit more optimistic about that because we've got precedent. So let me talk in real terms about what we do in Australia and how it connects globally. If you look at information security, which people care about, absolutely, with your bank, in the interactions you have in relation to your kids' schools, there's example after example. And we actually do have international agreement around cybersecurity standards. It's called ISO 27001. It does not solve the world's problems, but it's used by our major banks, who by and large, with very few exceptions, have done a great job around information security. It's used and it's mandated across the New South Wales government as baseline risk assurance. So we actually do have precedent where the corporate world, where experts in computer sciences and different governments actually do play together, and that's been the historical example we have to follow. So I'm much more optimistic about what we can do technically. The question Adrian was raising was really about political will, and that's something we'll continue to struggle over. The question of Australia's place in the world will be a discussion we keep having, and we'll have it for decades, and it's going to be full of fraught issues. But I think around the technical standards, and maybe Christina can speak to this too about precedent. We've got precedent to it. So when we dive down and we're calling on companies for their expertise, because they've got the engineers who do this daily, and that includes Data 61 with their depth of expertise, how do we make that global? Because ultimately, we also have trade obligations. So we can talk about our sovereign approach, but when you're a large procurer like state government or federal government, and you're looking to buy something off the shelf because you need that in a service provision environment, and we do it here with Service New South Wales and others who do a great job, and it's now been recognised as nationally significant, they need to have international standards that they can use in commercial agreements and the like. So we actually have something that has some teeth. It talks about how you do things in practice, not how you do things in theory, which is obviously always much harder. And it's very hard from accountability point of view.
These international discussions are fabulous. And I love all the efforts that are being undertaken all around the world to consider these issues, try to drive consensus. But I do worry sometimes. It's very easy for those of us on the panel, and especially those of us in big technology companies, to navel gaze a bit. And the reality is, this is our day job, right? These are wonderful public policy issues, and it's an incredible, incredible luxury to be able to think through these issues, hire philosophers, bring entire ethics departments in your organization. And yet I look around the room, we've had these events all around the country, and many of you have day jobs that aren't AI ethics. You have companies to run, real estate firms to manage, mines to engage, banks to run. And I do worry sometimes that while we're fixated on these incredibly interesting granular details, that it can be a bit off-putting to others who have to sift through what feels like an incredible amount of information overload. And as a very practical matter, while we're having these big global academic debates, there's absolutely nothing stopping organizations from starting down this AI ethics journey and, in fact, making incredibly real and great valuable progress on these front. We see this in customers all across Australia all the time. Not everybody has to do these big global engagements. It's very there's some very clear, reasonable, practical steps that so many of you are taking out there, even when it isn't your day job. And this is great, and we should continue this conversation, but we should make sure to recognize that it isn't the day job for many of you, and we should try on our end to make this real, practical, and realizable for all of you who, again, have your own jobs to run.
Thank you. I'm a little bit almost confused about whether or not it's the right thing to do to start making the practical steps before the helicopter kind of decisions are being made. But I don't know whether other panelists, I see some nodding heads, so anyone?
Yeah, I agree with you entirely. There's no there's no need for people to stop deploying AI or broader automated decision making processes in their businesses and wait for the OECD and the EU and the G20 and then perhaps the Australian government to come up with a consistent position. That way we'll be sitting around waiting for 20 years, I suspect. So absolutely, people should crack on. And then the question is how, from an ethical perspective, because we're talking about the ethics component here at this point, how they then operationalize a consideration of ethics into decisions about deploying a system or deploying a use case around an AI product, or even just something that's a little more mundane, that's an automated decision-making process, and making sure they apply their own appropriately contextual ethical considerations to that within the governance framework. So that's the job, I think, now.
Christina?
Yeah, I mean, Adrian talked about a lot of the principles that have been, you know, formulated part of the framework. I think the other really important thing is the operationalizing of those frameworks. And part of the work that I'm doing with the IEEE is looking at certification. So taking the principles one step further and thinking, well, how do we actually bring this to life? How do organisations get some form of certainty that you know, they say they're operating against these principles? How do you know they are? And for those of you that saw Dr. Alan Finkel's presentation in, I think it was May last year, he talked about an idea around the Turing certificate and what that could potentially mean in terms of handling a voluntary certification around ethical AI. So the IEEE is starting down that journey. It's an international certification that they're hoping to develop. But that's just one step. It's one means by, you know, to think about how you could operationalise this. It's certainly not the be-all and end-all.
Jed, did you want to comment on that?
I was going to say, some of that work's already underway, to get to Tom's point as well. So we've got people sitting in the audience, and Orly, and certainly more than a few of you, Gary as well, and you won't mind me naming you, are people who are starting to drive some of that process as well through our engagement internationally. So it's taking an Australian approach, previous experience in this space, and actually trying to get some of that stuff done. So that's got wheels already. And to Christina's point, there's work underway, for example, on the governance of AI within organisations, and that's really about, you know, using a standards-based approach like the one I described before, which is, what are the questions you need to frankly ask if you're on a board or, you know, you're in an executive role in an organisation and you're actually not close to the coding and all the language which, you know, everyone talks about. But let's be real, decision-makers in an organisation at the moment are not at that level of familiarity. So this is about equipping them with the toolkit, to Christina's point, so they can ask the right questions before we do something at an enterprise level, before we get a company down that track. And then we realise there's, you know, maybe legal issues or a whole range of things that should help address that. So I think that work's already underway. But to Tom's other point, I think we also need to get real about the application of AI. And I think financial services is a great example, credit card fraud, you know, the work that banks do in that space makes it real. I think also in areas that are not sexy, but actually people do care about, like child protection, predictive risk modelling. We've got great examples and case studies we can draw on, including from across the Tasman, where they were looking at more targeted investment, and where it's been fraught with sort of political risk as well. So we've been there, we've done the work, and we've validated the approaches technically and the models that could be used. And I think we do need to elevate that as well, because I do worry sometimes, to Tom's point, that we get into these broad discussions of geopolitics or risk, like, you know, privacy and the like. But I don't think for many people, certainly probably in the audience, but in society, that's not how you want to engage people. You want to talk about how it could save a child's life, how this prevents you from being a victim of fraud. That's what machine learning and AI is about at an everyday level. And then I think a separate discussion is around the growth of these sectors in Australia, which is that outward-focusing export lens, which is, again, very different about the intrinsic benefit of AI.
So, first of all, I want to commend Microsoft is doing great work, and the world needs companies like Microsoft developing these tools to accelerate adoption. But I want to give you another perspective, which is, so I spent 18 years out of this country in the US as an entrepreneur and business builder. And we started what has now become the global leader I was a founder of in device security. And when we started that, no one was having the conversations about just because we can connect all of this equipment, should we? And what we're finding ourselves now is we've got a world full of, you know, compromised systems that's not only protecting mission-critical but life-critical systems. You can't retroactively fix all of that. So another example is the internet itself, right? The hippies in California wanted the internet to be free, and the business model that emerged from that was an advertising-based model that's led to sophisticated surveillance systems to understand who we are and serve up commercial messages. If we'd have stopped and had the conversation up front, maybe we'd end up with a different internet today. Likewise with IoT, maybe we'd end up with inherently secure equipment. Now, what I'm talking about is an optimization decision for an industry or a country or the world. I think everyone in the room, if you're working for a firm, aside from personal values and beliefs, has an obligation to deliver value for shareholders. So pragmatically, absolutely, go on and experiment and apply and think about the application of AI. But I do think we need to have these conversations now.
Now and into the future. So we know that values are not locked in stone. They're not carved somewhere and they never change. So, and particularly when you come to the trade-offs, so when you say could and should, and those hippies did exactly what they thought was the right thing to do. So I think that's the really tricky part, to not only have ethical standards or principles or whatever they are, but how is it that over time they keep up with the way that people are changing? But another question is, how will AI change our values as well? So we were talking at lunch, you know, would your daughter say something is the innovation is the most important thing and the coolness and we can solve this problem? And for that person, privacy might be not nearly as important. So how is it that we can over time keep up with these kinds of trends, and will they change because of AI? I see you looking at the mic.
Let me call out two little concrete examples. As a lawyer at Microsoft, I spent a lot of years counseling many of our product developers, the engineers, folks like that. And certainly 10, 20 years ago, to Adrian's point, when you talk about privacy and security with engineers, they're beholden to the algorithm. You know, it's what can you do? I think that's changed a lot. And I think AI has very much changed that. And I'll highlight, about a year or so ago, we issued a global call for regulation of facial recognition. And it's sort of a classic thing that historically a lot of the engineers would have said, lawyers, get out of my business. And yet we had broad consensus across our tens of thousands of engineers that this was a window, this was the right thing to do. And I think it is many of the issues that Adrian has flagged, I think it's this changing sense of the ethics around data that caused people to support it. About 9 months ago, we issued a different edict. This time we identified a series of steps that we were requiring our engineers to take around the development of AI bots, including, for example, an obligation that we always tell the human when they're speaking with a bot as opposed to a human. Again, 10, 15 years ago, the engineers would have absolutely recoiled at that sort of mandate coming from legal. This time, complete consensus. Everybody saw it. They realized the importance. That, to me, shows the evolution of ethical thinking. And if you can move the minds of the engineers, I think the rest of society shouldn't be too far behind.
I was going to say, that actually points to the question of functional trust. When things work as they're supposed to and people have an experience they expect, they're more likely to buy into that vision. And I mean, you see that in different areas of application. So it's not just me talking, but you know, there was a global study done, and it was by BCG, which looked at attitudes towards AI across different countries, including in Australia. And what you found was a bit of a gradient in terms of what they're willing to entertain. So, you know, the stuff we look at when we're in a commute in the afternoon, and we go to, you know, let's call it for what it is, but we use Google, and that's real-time driven by machine learning. We tend to have a high level of trust in that, and we love it because we see the trade-off as being very low, even though we are sharing information about who we are and where we are. The question around visa processing, again, surprisingly, has large support in Australia because people who have partners and et cetera, know how long that takes when it's a process that can be speeded up exponentially. So that's a fascinating case too. And then the final one where it's a bit more difficult, of course, is in the area of sentencing, which people don't much love. Surprise, surprise. But the story is actually more nuanced in the US than it gets told in short sound bites. But it gives you a feel for how people are willing to trade off some of those things around privacy and the strange relationship we do have around privacy. So posting things on social media publicly, you know, even without any restrictions on who sees that, and then wanting to preserve our privacy is a very, very, very strange position to occupy and pretend you're being consistent and coherent, because your actions and your supposed values do strike you as being at variance. So I think, to Tom's point, and also to Adrian's, we've got a changing relationship. Some of that will be good, both within companies in terms of their attitudes towards how these things are deployed. Others will be very difficult to grapple with, because when I sat in government, we commissioned research on that too. And it threw up some really paradoxical findings, which we struggled with, which was, I want a seamless service from government, like you get elsewhere. I want to know that when I go to the service centre, I'm Adrian Turner or Jed Horner, or whatever the case may be, and I want you to know who I am. But then citizens weren't happy to trade off information in relation to that. So there's all these tricky questions which I don't have an answer to, and people won't, but I think it points to the changing nature of our digital world and the tricky thing for regulators, for companies too, how do you keep track of that? One model is to keep doing research and to keep engaging so you know your client base and the citizens. But it's a tricky question when you're trying to set standards or rules, because that's shifting almost daily.
Well, even within person, as you say. Sorry, Christine.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I mean, I happily get into an Uber with a complete stranger now, whereas 10 years ago, that would have been a very foreign concept. I happily rent out my apartment on Airbnb to a complete stranger. Again, something that would have been quite foreign 10 years ago. I think in a similar way, exactly what you said, our expectations as society are changing due to the nature of we've got this technology at our fingertips. And I think with this whole concept of ethical AI, the challenge is you can have a very ethical algorithm, but it could get picked up by an unethical individual or company. And so the question is, you know, you can put all the safeguards in from an AI perspective, from a technology perspective, but technology aside, are we addressing some of the bigger issues that we have in society around ethics and trust? And until we address that issue, we'll still face these issues when it comes to AI.
One last comment, Adrian.
Yeah, so just if you look in the past, consumers or customers would hold companies to account with their wallet. Don't like what you're doing, I'll move. I think what's different about some of what's going on now. What's different now is some of these new businesses are naturally monopolistic and the switching costs are incredibly high, when the value is insights that have been built algorithmically over time. And that was one of the underlying things for the consumer data rights. But the thing that I wonder, right, if you look at Facebook, if you look at any other kind of period looking back where, you know, a company has overreached so far in terms of, you know, that trust and their position, and yet they're not losing users by droves. So why is that? There's this codependency that gets created with these AI-based systems. So, you know, I don't have the answer, but it feels like there needs to be some protective provisions in there for individuals and the portability between AI-based services.
Perfect. Just want to have some time for questions, because I'm sure all of you are thinking of great questions that you might want to ask someone on the panel. So I'll ask you, there are people with mics around the room. If you could put your hand up and someone will come over to you with a mic. You see people over here with signs if you want to hold them up. And please say your name, who you are, and state your question. And as tempting as it might be to provide some commentary for us, please try to keep it to a brief question. Thank you. Who would like to be first? Ah, I see someone. Can you, oh, there we are.
Thanks, everyone, for your insights. My name's Elise Su from Transhumanism. I heard you mention something about the internet and how we should have put in more security protocols around that. I believe the internet is it's very important for democratizing a lot of industries and allowing people to access things that they wouldn't have in the past, like media, being able to create their own videos, YouTube, Medium as examples. So my question is, are you also proposing that there should be more protocols around who gets access to AI?
Is there someone in particular you wanted to ask the question of?
Perhaps Adrian. I think you mentioned something about the internet.
Yeah, I did. Look, I haven't given a lot of thought to... I mean, there's not about particularly accessing AI. It's not a stretch logically to think about, you know, the value for internet access, and that, you know, people talk about that being a human right to being able to access systems as well. But the honest answer is I haven't given a lot of thought to that particular.
Might just say something, which is that, in fact, most of the policymakers have thought about it in the reverse to date. So they've been thinking about it from the perspective of an individual's right, A, to have transparency about whether AI is being used in relation to them, and then B, their ability to effectively opt out or to have human intervention come in and replace the automated decision-making. We saw that for the first time in the GDPR, the General Data Protection Regulation in Europe, which is the first time that concept had really been enshrined into law. And that concept of transparency and then also opt-out or ability to interpose a human, a real person, is really coming up in most of the framework discussions that are being held at the moment. So actually, it's really being thought about from the other perspective, I think.
I was going to say as well, I think it's not directed at the panel, but I mean, I think if you look at the comments Mark Zuckerberg made, he was a person recently talking about the regulation of the internet, no one on this panel. So
was it the real Zuckerberg?
The real Zuckerberg, not the deep fake. But again, a double-edged sword, because you talk about democratization. I mean, in some contexts, we've actually seen different platforms played off against one another for those purposes. So to make it even more real, in South Africa, you had Twitter being co-opted along racial lines, targeted at particular political actors. The company implicated in driving that messaging went out of business. So it's a positive news story in terms of accountability. And Facebook was on the other side of that dilemma. So we've got this weird positioning where contextually, depending on where you're talking, there's real instances of platforms being used to undermine democracy or variously to strengthen it and to strengthen accountability. And actors fall in different ways depending on where they're operating and the platforms populations use. So it's a very nuanced discussion. I don't want to get into detail on that now.
Thanks. We have a question over here.
Owen Hayford from PwC. Look, my question's for each member of the panel. It's a quick question. If you could enact one piece of legislation to make illegal an activity that's going on within the AI sphere, what would it be?
I think the sweeping statement "make illegal" is a bit too strong. I think one thing we need to be careful of are these broad platitudes. There's an incredible amount of nuance that underlies here. As folks have mentioned in the last answer, there are some fact patterns that may be completely acceptable, but you tweak one little factual nuance and it's totally fine. In terms of a subject area that I would focus on, as I mentioned earlier, it's facial recognition for us. We think that is an issue that cuts ultimately to so many core issues of fundamental human rights. And it is in such great play at the moment that if there was one area, and not hypothetically, we're actually pushing governments around the world to very much focus on that area, think through the process deliberatively, collaboratively, bring in civil society, standards groups, all the rest of it. But that would be our focal area at the moment.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I think it's hard to pick something to say it should be made illegal, but I am quite affected by the work that Toby Walsh has been doing in recent times on the use of AI in warfare. So I'm not saying that we should make warfare illegal, but I am saying I think that is one of the big, and this is a personal view, but I think that has got to be one of the massive areas for focus to really refine clear rules of engagement in autonomous warfare campaigns.
Christina?
Mine's slightly different. I think the biggest challenge we have is around education. So for me, it would be more disclosure around how AI is getting built into the products and services we consume. I think we need a lot more focus on how we educate consumers who today pretty much have no idea whether they're using AI and how that's, you know, how their data is being used. So that would be mine.
Jed?
Mine would be a little bit out of left field but completely related, which is, from a personal viewpoint, a comprehensive Bill of Rights for all Australians. You can't talk about issues like bias and about obligations on companies unless, as a government, you've actually sorted out what your ethical values are as reflected in legislation. And the extension of that being, once you have that in place, which is about protecting everyone's rights to privacy and the like, it's a consolidation exercise in tribal Australia, is to do what the UK government has done in different areas like race disparity audits, which actually talk about what are the issues in your society before you start with a massive beam in your eye, tackling corporates or other groups of actors and saying you're all driving this bias. What are the biases and differences in life expectancy and things like that that exist in Australia now? And so that will be the starting point for me. If we want to talk about ethics, it's about having a legal framework which is real and embeds that every day.
Adrian?
The thing that I think is a big challenge, I mean, there's lots of challenges, is digital supply chain and transparency in and around the digital supply and data supply chain. We did a report, we published it a few weeks back, looking at just one website, and there were 30 individual scripts and third parties delivering content and data up into that one single website. So it was 30 layers deep. So how can you, you know, assure that's a trusted service that's being offered? So I think the whole intangible digital supply chain, data supply chain, needs more transparency.
Thank you.
Thank you. Picking up the last two points, Michael Perkins from Nexus Law Group. Given that the Commonwealth Government has signed on to the UN Convention for the Rights of People with Disabilities, Adrian, how was this considered in the development of your AI framework?
So, I mean, the short answer is that it was. I saw a presentation actually from Microsoft recently. Just the number of people that either have a visible or a non-visible disability was, from memory, it was around 30%. I mean, it's a huge part of the population. So it was a pervasive and inherent part of the thinking and is included in it.
We have a question up here.
Andrew Horsley, CEDAR trustee. What does the panel think of China as a nation state? How would you address it as a nation state with what you all had to say?
Adrian to be the first responder. Yeah. We can all follow suit.
I was figuring out how to get off stage. Sorry, what was the... how do we consider China in this? What was the question?
I was busy trying to figure out what question is up here. I'm sorry. Maybe you could repeat the question.
China operates all aspects of what each member of the panel had to say today. How would you individually address what you had to say with regard to China as a nation state?
Okay, so I'm not going to talk from CSIRO's perspective. So you asked for a personal... This is my personal opinion and view. So I think China highlights the complexity of what we're talking about here. So on the one hand, you could look at China score and say... that's not a just system. On the other hand, you could look at that and say, you've got this massive migration of people to cities, and how do you facilitate an environment where those people can trust one another in that new city? So to me, it's just an incredibly, you know, highlights the complexity of what we're talking about. But as I said when I spoke, AI is fundamentally about data. And if we were talking about this over lunch, if there's government sponsorship of private enterprise and access to those data sets to be able to train those data sets and deliver more effective services that can then be exported, I think there's potentially unfair competitive advantage for those companies.
So instead of having everyone answer the question, unless there's a burning desire, there's a lot of questions around, so I wanted to open it up to other people. So there's a question over here.
Hi, Deborah Lau from Chartered Accountants Australia and New Zealand. So as an educator, I guess my biggest concern about AI coming is we're getting all sorts of debate about what should you educate people in the future to do because of the risk around automation of many tasks. Now, while I think there's going to be many more other tasks created where, you know, human and machine will work together, what are the panel's thoughts on the value of teaching people how to do the tasks that will be automated? Because with the advent of, you know, say, the internet, I don't remember a lot of trivia anymore. I just Google it. And does that make me dumber as a person, right?
So, Christina. Someone.
Working for a very large accounting firm, I can tell you that technology is enhancing our people and what they do rather than the other way around. We have a huge program at the moment to upskill some of our most junior people in the areas of technology, be it in analytics, robotics, a number of other areas. We're of the opinion that this technology is freeing our people up to focus on more value-added tasks. And we see that every day. 10 years ago, you would have accountants come in photocopying and picking up evidence. Kids coming out of universities these days, they're very intelligent. They don't want to be doing those tasks. So automation and AI is enabling people to focus on more higher value-added tasks. And I think that is a huge advantage for the kids coming up through universities today. And the trick for us is to make sure we keep up with the pace and keep them educated. That's a real challenge, and it's a real strain on the corporate sector because it's happening across every sector and that talent is in demand.
Gavin?
I couldn't agree more. I mean, as a law firm, we're in many ways in exactly the same boat, and there are lots of things that we do that young lawyers have for centuries done that they would quite willingly give up, I think. And in fact, we're seeing now that it means we're diversifying some of the skill sets that we hire into our firm. So we, in very recent times, have hired our first machine learning product rule builders into the firm. And that's something a law firm would never have done even 2 years ago, really particularly. And we've done that because we are, together with an AI, a product based here in Australia, building a compliance tool for big financial services companies. And we are actually building the rules that sit within that AI product. So that's a new opportunity for us and new people we will hire into the firm.
I was going to pick that up. I mean, for us, standards are documents you often access in PDF, so hello, old world. But with RegTech, what we've actually done, and I'm pleased to say that, is engage with a lot of local homegrown companies, and we are now trialling and testing new approaches to how those standards can be made available in more real and visual formats, which I think is an example of where we're sharing learnings in our organisation. And of course, you could always ask questions on the pace of change, so that's piloting things, and you want to see the scale of those, but it's a journey we're on. And I think, to Christina's point, showcasing that internally, trying to get people on board to that agenda is a critical part of raising awareness or education around machine learning and AI broadly.
We could have a whole discussion about how universities could assist in this process as well. The last question up here at the front.
Thank you for a very interesting panel. Recently, my name is Anthony Wong. I'm a lawyer as well as a technologist. Recently, I was fortunate to work on the GDPR European Union on just on this AI topic about explaining AI. And recently, I also worked with the Sydney Business School on a panel to answer this question. If we have deep learning AI, how do we go about explaining this? Because particularly when you use AI in government agencies, you have to explain the reasons behind certain decisions in administrative law. So this is a question for the panel. Knowing there are current limitations to AI deep learning, what's the best way to overcome this limitation in the meantime while we work for a solution towards the longer term? Thank you.
Anyone?
From my perspective, the best place to start is to not try to boil the ocean. You know, what you just identified is, in a very practical terms, is a very technical legal limitation in debate. There are some use cases right now that just simply aren't legal because you can't explain the algorithm, you can't do things like that. That doesn't mean that the AI work in that organization grinds to a halt. There are still tremendous other opportunities. There are lots of things you can do in that space and lots of things organizations in this room are doing in this space, even if there happen to be specific issues here, there, and the other place where they might be blocked at the moment. The point ultimately is try some smaller things, break it out into chunks, test your scenario, work through the ethical principles, and then move on to the next one. That's the best way to ultimately get to a place where you've deployed as much as you can deploy, but you feel comfortable that you've deployed it in the best, most ethical way possible.
Thank you. I'd now like to thank you for all your great questions. I'd like to invite Colin Dominish to the stage to wind up the event.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Every day of the week, we have to make choices. And this morning, you would have got out of bed and made a decision about what you would like for breakfast, what you're going to wear, and I'm hoping a few of you decided whether or not you'd brush your teeth. And as we make those choices, we're putting in place a whole lot of frameworks and understanding to be able to do so. GHD Digital works with our clients in the area of infrastructure assets and makes choices very much based on integrity, things that are going to create lasting community benefit. And as we move into this new world of AI and everything that it brings with it, what will keep us going for the next 90 years, based on the history that we've had for the last 90 years, is one of our core values, which is integrity. So now we've got to work out, how do we get that integrity and instill it within computers who are now making those choices for us? And are we ready for those choices to be made? I love how Adrian talked today about the overview effect and what that would look like if we can encapsulate that in our computer algorithms to make choices. How do we get computers to think like we do about the planet that we live on? The good news was, Adrian shared with us, that there are a number of existing frameworks in place for ethics, and all we've really got to do is put those frameworks in context. We're developing those frameworks further with principles and a toolkit that are going to help us understand how does AI fit within that existing framework and how do we therefore drive that forward. The panel made the point that clients are already moving on this very quickly. In fact, even the engineers I heard, which is great to hear from our perspective. Standards are being defined. Everyone around the world is looking for ways that we can bring that integrity into the system. So the choice is there for you to work out right now, what are you doing to have ethical AI in everything that you're doing? How are you instilling that within the education and training of your teams? The way in which your company or organisation is making day-to-day decisions. The choice is now to make around that so that we don't lose advantage and we do it in a proper way. So what's your approach? And what choice are you going to make while you still can, before a computer makes it for you? I'd really like to thank our panellists today, and I'll start with Adrian, of course, with his fantastic presentation. I'm always delighted to hear what Adrian has to say. He brings a real world view to the conversation, and you've done so again for us today. So thank you so much for that. Great to hear the standards perspective from Jed and what Standards Australia are doing to help us all to make the right choices along the way. So thank you, Jed, for helping out in that regard. Companies like EY, represented by Christina Larkin here today, have so much to do to help us in terms of seeing where are others on that journey and how can we learn from others in a collaborative way to get integrity in place as we move forward. So thank you, Christina, for your insights on that. Gavin, similarly from Allens, being able to present a view that makes sure that we're doing it with a level of compliance that's going to be robust enough to serve us well for the future. So thank you, Gavin. And Tom, I think, highlighted through a number of examples today where one of the world's largest companies benefiting from the AI juggernaut is also doing so with the conscious. So Tom, thank you for some of the examples that you shared on that today and everything that Microsoft's doing to make sure we get this right. Can I please ask you all to thank our guests for today?